Gudrun came to an embarrassed halt as the jukebox simply died, followed by the factory lights. She stared at her partner in shock for a long moment, then realized, as murmurs ran through the crowd, that someone must have turned off the electricity. She'd heard her father moaning about the cost of power often enough to know that the mains could be cut off in a power station rather than at home, but she hadn't realized it could happen to a factory, too. And then she heard a rattling sound echoing from the police barricades. "Get into the gates!" someone shouted. "Get into the gates!" It was too late. The striking workers were already closing the gates, readying themselves, she saw now, for an assault. She turned, realizing in horror that the sense of freedom had vanished as the crowd started to scatter. The sound of armored vehicles and the steady rattling was growing louder, bearing down on them from all directions. She heard a popping sound in the distance, followed by screams. What the hell were they doing? They weren't shooting, she was sure. Or were they? Maybe the government had just decided to gun down the strikers rather than try to negotiate. She gritted her teeth, then turned and ran, pushing her way through the crowd towards the brick walls. She'd be safer there, she thought. But the sound was growing louder. The crowd recoiled around her. She saw, as she broke free, a line of black-clad men advancing towards them, banging their clubs against riot shields. They'd been paying attention in the Hitler Youth, her mind frantically noted. They might have been walking towards a panicking mob of civilians, but they were banging their shields in perfect unison. White mist surrounded them, blowing towards the crowd. Her eyes started to water as the mist surrounded her. The policemen stopped, still banging their shields. She stared, just for a moment, then blinked in surprise as she saw an armored vehicle advancing slowly behind the policeman, who opened ranks to allow it to crawl forward. Gudrun wondered, in shock, if they were about to be mowed down with machine guns, just before the water cannons started to spew water towards the crowd. She had no time to duck before ice-cold water slammed into her, sending her falling to the ground. Her clothes were so drenched that it was hard to move. She found herself shivering helplessly as the policemen resumed their advance. She tried to crawl backwards, although she was sure the police were advancing from all directions, but it was too late. Strong hands grabbed her, shoved her down to the tarmac, and yanked her hands behind her back. There was no time to object before she was cuffed and helpless.
"Stay there," a voice growled.
She felt a hand hastily frisking her, then giving her bottom a hard squeeze.
"Don't move a muscle."
Gudrun tensed, expecting to feel hands slipping into her bra or panties, or worse. But instead, her captor just walked away. The cuffs were tight, so tight her wrists were rapidly beginning to ache. She strained against them for a long moment before realizing that it was hopeless, that there was no way human muscle could break free. Instead, she turned and saw hundreds of people, strikers, students, lying on the ground, being steadily rounded up and cuffed. The factory gates were still shut, but it was no consolation. It wouldn't be long before the policemen smashed them down and arrested the rest of the strikers. She shivered as a cold wind blew over Berlin. They'd talked about what would happen if they were caught, but she'd never really believed they would be caught. And now she had been caught, as a protester rather than one of the Valkyries. And her luck had finally run out. Chapter 28. Berlin, Germany. 12 August, 1985.
"They're clearing the streets," Joachim said.
"Looks that way,"
Volker agreed. He cursed under his breath. The policemen, they looked like military policemen to him, although it was hard to be sure, had handled everyone trapped on the wrong side of the gates with brutal efficiency. Now that the gas was fading away, they were rounding up the protesters and marching them towards a line of black prisoner transports. God alone knew what would happen to them, but he doubted it would be anything pleasant. And once the impromptu street party had been smashed, the policemen would turn their attention to the strikers.
"The generator is up and running," Joachim offered, "but they've definitely cut the telephone and computer landlines."
"And now we're isolated," Walker said.
12 factories had joined the strike, but now, with the policemen blocking the roads, each factory was on its own.
"This could get messy."
"Yeah,"
Joachim agreed,
"but I don't regret anything. Do you?"
Volker shrugged. The policemen hadn't yet tried to batter down the gates or come over the walls. They had to know the strikers had very few weapons. Giving Volker's people time to improvise a few nasty surprises would be a dangerous mistake. Very few people realized just how easy it was to produce weapons, given the right tools and materials, and the strikers had plenty of both. But they wouldn't be enough to keep the policemen out forever.
"Make sure we keep the food strictly rationed," he ordered.
If the policemen didn't intend to storm the gates, it could only be because they thought starvation would do the job. And they were probably right. There was a vast stockpile of food in the building, but it wouldn't last for more than a few days, even if the cooks stretched it as much as possible.
"We'll see if they're more willing to talk after a few days of no production."
He smiled rather wanly. Losing even a day's work would cause knock-on effects further down the line. The longer the strike lasted, even if it was broken and the workers put back to work once it came to an end, the more damage it would cause the Reich. And if half the workers were killed or arrested, it would be impossible to restore the production lines. In their place, he would have tried to negotiate some sort of compromise.
"But the SS isn't known for compromise," he thought. He ought to know. He'd been an SS officer.
They may be plotting to strike without realizing that they're striking at the heart of the Reich.
"Get on your feet," a policeman snapped. "Now!"
Gudrun could barely move. She was almost grateful when a policeman caught hold of her arm and half-dragged her to her feet. Her wrists ached. Her face hurt where she'd hit the roadside when she'd been knocked down by the water cannons. Her drenched clothes clung to her skin, revealing every one of her curves. Gritting her teeth, reminding herself that it was likely to get a good deal worse, she looked around in horror as the policeman pushed her into a long line of prisoners. The street looked like a nightmare. A handful of dead bodies, including 4 children, lay on the ground, while hundreds of men and women were being pushed towards the transport vans.
"Keep your mouth shut," one of the policemen snapped when a young man tried to ask a question.
The speaker recoiled, too late to avoid a punishing blow from a truncheon.
"Say nothing unless you are spoken to."
The policemen seemed to be organized, Gudrun admitted ruefully, as she was finally prodded into a prisoner transport van. It smelled bad, worse than Grandpa Frank's room after a particularly bad night. She heard a number of her fellow prisoners gagging as they were shoved roughly into the van and told to sit on the hard metal floor. Gudrun was almost relieved it was dark inside, save for a handful of air slits too high to reach, even if she hadn't been cuffed by the police. The doors were banged shut once the van was full. There were so many people in the vehicle that she couldn't help feeling claustrophobic, and the engines roared to life. She tried to guess where they were going, but rapidly found it impossible. The RSHA itself? A camp outside the city? A makeshift detention center? Or would they simply be dumped on the far side of Berlin and told to make their own way home? She clung to the final thought, even though she knew it was unlikely. The government would hardly be content with drenching her and the others. "But they don't know anything," she thought. As far as she knew, she was the only one of the Valkyries who had gone to the factories. Horst knew she'd gone, of course, but no one else did. They might never know what had happened to her, and yet, they'd worry that she'd tell her captors everything. She knew the names and faces of everyone who'd joined the original Valkyries. "What happens if they make me talk?" The thought chilled her to the bone as the vehicle lurched.
Someone was crying softly. It sounded like a young girl. But what did she have to worry about? She was innocent of everything apart from being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Gudrun, on the other hand, if someone connected her to Conrad, and perhaps Conrad's father, they might start wondering just what else she was connected to. They'd check her records, identify her as a student, and then wonder if she was involved with the Valkyries. It wouldn't take them long, if Horst was right, to break her. Unless, of course, they didn't believe their luck. She flinched as someone spoke into the darkness.
What are they going to do to us?
Kill us, someone else said, or put us in the camps. Gudrun shuddered. There had always been dark rumors, even before she'd started the Valkyries. There had always been suggestions of what happened to those who failed to fit into the Reich. And, after what Grandpa Frank had said, they might be driven to a camp, forced into a gas shower and exterminated. She thought, she still thought, that the Reich wouldn't dare harm so many Berliners, in plain view of the entire city, but it was hard not to fear the worst. Her family might never know what had happened to her. Tears welled at the corner of her eyes as the vehicle lurched one final time, then came to a halt. She would have given anything to see her parents one last time, to make her apologies in person, to ask them if they were proud of her. Hell, she would have given up her university career. And yet, Conrad and the hundreds of others like him had never had that option. Surrendering now would mean that they'd died and been wounded for nothing, that the government had got away with its crimes. She flicked her head, forcing the tears away as she heard the door slowly being unlocked. There would be a chance to escape, she told herself, and if she saw it, she would take it.
Climb out of the vehicle and walk straight through the door in front of you unless you are drawn aside, a voice ordered.
Gudrun flinched away from the light pouring in through the open door.
Sit down on the floor, then wait. Do not speak to your fellows.
Gudrun looked around as she was helped out of the van, then pushed towards the door. They were in a garage, she thought, a chamber large enough to house several giant prisoner transports. A policeman was standing by the door, eyeing her with cold blue eyes. She forced herself to keep her head up straight as he held up a hand to stop her, then frisked her with brutal efficiency. She was tempted to point out that she'd already been frisked once, but she suspected there was no point. Inside, there was another large chamber, totally bare save for a large portrait of the Führer, looking unrealistically stern. The painter had done something to the image, she realized as she sat down on the hard floor. The eyes looked as though they were following her around the room. It should have been funny, but it was actually alarmingly intimidating. No men, she realized as she looked around carefully. The only prisoners in the room were female. They must have been sent to a different room. She forced herself to try to remember what her father had said, back when he'd been trying to interest Johann in joining the police force rather than volunteering for the military. The policemen on the streets handed prisoners over to the policemen in the station, who processed them and determined their fate. It all seemed rather slapdash to her, but if her father was to be believed, prisoners were rarely innocent. The only real question was if they would be sent to jail or transported east to help make Germany East safe for German citizens. She shuddered bitterly, remembering what Horst had said, then forced herself to relax as best as she could. The long wait, in handcuffs and freezing cold clothes, was probably just another attempt to wear her down before the interrogation began. The door opened. A grim-faced policeman entered the room, picked a girl at random, and marched her back through the door, which closed behind them with a loud thud. Gudrun wondered briefly what the girl had done to deserve being picked first, then decided it didn't matter. She had a feeling she'd go through the whole process herself soon enough. The door opened again, revealing a different policeman who took a different girl. Gudrun almost giggled as her dazed mind wondered if the girls were being taken for a dance. Her blood ran cold. There were horror stories, darker horror stories, about girls who went to semi-legal dances and raves. Her father had never let her go, even with Conrad. She'd never dared to defy him. Not when many of her friends were also forbidden to attend. And the policemen were taking the girls. She suddenly felt very vulnerable and helpless. They wanted her to feel that way, she was sure, and yet, it was working. Patience, she told herself firmly, as the door opened again and a policeman walked towards her. Conrad went through worse. You can get through this. The policeman helped her to her feet with surprising gentleness, then escorted her into a corridor and down towards a large metal door set within the stone wall. It opened with a series of clicks. Gudrun couldn't help wondering just how many locks had been worked into the door, revealing another cold chamber. It was bare, save for a single metal table. Two stern-faced men sat behind it. The table, and their chairs, were firmly fixed to the floor. "You are under arrest," one of the men said. The policeman who'd escorted her to the room stepped backwards until he was standing in front of the door. The only door. There was no hope of escape. "If you cooperate, it will be noted. Do you understand me?" Gudrun nodded, feeling her heartbeat starting to race. Any hope she'd had of escaping, of vanishing into the streets, was gone. She fought to keep her breathing under control, knowing it was a losing battle. This was worse, far worse, than being forced to write lines or having her hand swatted with a ruler. "Good," the man said. "Name?"
"Gudrun Wieland,"
Gudrun said. It was hard to speak. Her thoughts ran in all directions. She hoped her parents wouldn't get into trouble. She'd known some parents who had got into trouble because their children were little brats, but the kids had been much younger than 18. Gudrun was old enough to be accountable for herself, yet she was also a girl, an unmarried girl. Her father could be punished if she stepped too far out of line. "Noted," the man said. His voice was flat, utterly atonal, but there was a hint of something unpleasant in it. "There are checks we have to perform. If you cooperate, everything will go smoothly and swiftly. If you refuse to cooperate, we will carry them out by force, and you will find them thoroughly unpleasant. Are you going to cooperate?"
"Yes, sir," Gudrun said.
"Remove the cuffs," the man ordered. Gudrun let out a sigh of relief as her hands were released. She brought them around and stared at her wrists. The skin was badly bruised. She rubbed them frantically, trying to get some sensation back into her hands, but she felt nothing. She couldn't help wondering if she'd lost all feeling in them for good. The policeman let her have a moment to work her hands, then tapped the table impatiently. Gudrun couldn't help feeling a flicker of amusement as she realized there were three men guarding her, as if they considered her a deadly threat. She knew, without false modesty, that she couldn't hope to beat even one of them in a fight. One of the policemen produced an ink pad and a pad of paper. Gudrun had had her fingerprints taken before, the day she'd entered school. She recalled, with a hint of bitter shame, that she'd considered it fun. Now, it was terrifying. Her anonymity was being stripped from her piece by piece. If there was a single fingerprint of hers anywhere on the leaflets, they'd know who she was. And then it would be over. "Very good," the policeman said, once the whole process was complete. His companion removed the fingerprint paperwork, then produced a small metal box from under the table and put it on the top. "Now, I want you to remove your clothing, piece by piece, and pass each item to me."
"I can't,"
Gudrun objected. She hadn't taken off her clothes in front of a stranger since her last medical examination, and the doctor had been female. Even Conrad had never seen her naked.
You
can either undress on your own, in which case the clothing will eventually be returned to you,
or you will be cuffed and your clothing will be cut away, the policeman said. He didn't show any hint of anticipation, but his companion was clearly looking forward to the display. Gudrun shivered as his eyes crawled over her body.
There will be no second chance to cooperate.
They'll want to degrade you, Horst had warned, back when he'd talked about how prisoners were treated. They'll want to make it clear that you are no longer in control of your own life. Gudrun shuddered. She'd never been allowed to wear something revealing, not even when she'd been at home. Tight jeans had shown off her curves, but not her bare skin. Her cheeks burned with shame at the thought of being so exposed. And yet, she knew they weren't joking. If they stripped her themselves, it would be far worse. Gritting her teeth, she undid her shirt slowly, trying to pretend that she was undressing for bed. She was damned if she was going to give them a strip show. She was grimly aware of their gazes, one lustful, one cold and dispassionate, as she removed her trousers and stood in front of them, wearing only her bra and panties. Bracing herself, she slowly removed her last protections and stood naked in front of them. The policeman by the door was breathing heavily. She wanted to curse him, even as the policeman inspected her last few articles of clothing and dropped them into the box, covering her breasts with one hand and the crack between her legs with the other. She wanted to run, but there was nowhere to go. She wanted to cry, but she didn't dare admit weakness. It would be disastrous.
Hands on your head, the policeman ordered.
Gudrun hated him in that moment. Hated him with a helpless fury she hadn't felt for anyone else, not even the worst of the BDM matrons. But she did as she was told, trying not to look at them studying her. She had never been so exposed in her entire life. Their eyes were trailing over her breasts, drinking in every detail. They had to know she was completely clean. Where could she hide anything now she'd been stripped naked?
Turn around, the policeman ordered coldly.
He rose to his feet and walked around the table.
Bend over and grab your ankles.
Gudrun stared at him in disbelief, but there was no point in trying to argue. All she wanted was to get it over with as quickly as possible. She turned and bent over, grimly aware that they were seeing far too much of her. Cold hands gripped her buttocks and pulled them apart. She cringed, half expecting to feel a finger poking up inside her most private parts before she was released.
Stand, the policeman ordered.
He was already walking back around the table, as if violating Gudrun's most intimate parts was nothing.
Cuff her, then take her to the holding cell.
It had been nothing, Gudrun realized, as the policeman snapped the cuffs back on, trapping her hands behind her back. They didn't know who she was, or what she'd done. They were just showing off their power. It was crude. It was effective. And yet, it had failed. They hadn't broken her. You don't know who I am, she thought, as she was pushed into a small holding cell. She might be naked, she might be cuffed, but she felt as though she had won. You don't know who I am, and that means I still have a chance. Chapter 29. Berlin, Germany. 12 August, 1985.
Ah, there you are, Frau Morgenstern said as Hilda stepped into the room. I trust you are ready to go out.
Hilda looked up, surprised.
Mother? They're arresting children on the streets, Frau Morgenstern said tartly. Children who could be you if things were different. Something has to be done.
She went on before Hilda could say a word.
I'm heading straight to Zilgen's house, she added. The telephones are no longer working, so I want you to take a note to several others. We're going out into the streets in protest.
Mother, Hilda protested, you could wind up in jail.
So could you, her mother said. This is the one chance we have to make our voices heard, to ally ourselves with others who want change, and so I'm leading the way onto the streets.
She picked up a sheet of paper and started to scribble a quick note. Hilda stared at her, unable to quite believe what was happening. Her mother had been holding dozens of meetings, some more civilized than others, but it was hard to imagine her bossy mother leading a small army of women onto the street like common workers. And yet, her mother had been outraged at the suggestion she was still under her husband's thumb. The chance to insist on greater rights for women was not to be missed.
"Once you've delivered the note, I want you to come straight back home and wait," Frau Morgenstern added, as she folded the sheet of paper and passed it to Hilda. "You are not to go onto the streets yourself or leave the house for any reason at all. The maids will take care of you until your father comes home."
Hilda swallowed. She had no idea what her father would say if he discovered his wife was leading the protests on the street. But she had a nasty feeling he'd take it out on her. He couldn't stand up to his formidable wife, after all. Hilda had no idea why her father had even married her mother, unless there was money and a name involved somewhere. His career had probably benefited from her mother's quiet politicking on his behalf. Maybe it had benefited enough for him not to want to discard his wife.
"I understand," she said finally. "Be careful."
"They won't shoot us," Frau Morgenstern said firmly. "Each and every one of the women in the group has a powerful husband or family."
"Yeah," Hilda said. "Just make sure the police know that."
She glanced at the note. It was nothing more than a handful of lines, telling the recipients to assemble at the predetermined spot and headed for the door. There hadn't been any incidents in their part of Berlin, as far as she knew, but that was about to change. God alone knew what would happen when the wealthy and powerful women started marching in support of the strikers, and their list of demands. Bitterly, half wishing she'd never heard of Gudrun or allowed herself to be lured into the Valkyries, she hurried through the door and down the drive to the gates. She could be arrested if the police saw her on the streets. She could be taken into the RSHA and tortured until she confessed everything. The emergency broadcasts had taken over everything, even the handful of privately owned television sets. There was no excuse for being caught outside the home. But the thought of her mother's anger and her own position drove her on. "They won't be patrolling the streets here," she told herself, hoping desperately that she was right. Her father's house, it was effectively a mansion, was in the safest part of the city, where the wealthy and powerful lived. The men who owned these houses were among the chief supporters of the regime. "They'll be sending the police to the industrial zones." But she knew she wouldn't feel safe until she was back home, praying her mother returned safely.
"They arrested Gudrun?"
"It looks that way," Leopold said. "I didn't get a good view from my vantage point, but they were arresting and cuffing just about everyone on the streets. I'm pretty sure I saw Gudrun being manhandled into a police van. The factories are sealed off and isolated."
"Write down a list of names," Horst ordered.
The telephone lines might be down. Some bright spark in the RSHA had turned the civilian network off, but the computer network had barely been hampered. There was no way the state could cripple it without rendering it useless to themselves as well as the Valkyries. "Make sure you only list the students you know were taken into the vans." He thought fast. Gudrun had said she was going down to the factories, along with hundreds of other students. So it was likely she'd been arrested. He didn't think any other Valkyries had joined the protest. Leopold had found a place to watch rather than go all the way into the sealed zone. Yet there was no way to know for sure. It was unlikely Gudrun would be given any special treatment once she reached the processing center. But being strip-searched would be so outside her previous experience that it might break her. And if she provided a list of names to the SS, Horst and the other Valkyries would have bare hours to live. It would be simple enough to run, he knew. He'd been trained in escape and evasion. He could make it to the American embassy, if he tried, or head south to Switzerland, or head west to Vichy, France. It wouldn't be too hard to steal a fishing boat and flee to Britain. And yet, leaving now would mean abandoning all his hopes and dreams, and Gudrun. He didn't want to leave her in the Reich's clutches. Particularly as she might have kept her mouth shut, he thought. Gudrun might not have endured the worst of the Hitler Youth, but the BDM matrons had been thoroughly unpleasant, if not outright sadists. She knows to say nothing and hope.
Here, Leopold said. These are the students I know were arrested.
Horst glanced at the list. It was shorter than he'd expected, but in all the confusion a great many students would have been arrested or injured without anyone noticing. The police would have refrained from using lethal weapons, he was sure, yet tear gas alone could be nasty if the protesters were unprepared for its use. He'd have to make sure the next message that went out on the computer network included instructions for dealing with it.
Put it on the net, he ordered.
Sven took the list and hastily tapped it into the computer, then uploaded it. God alone knew how many people it would reach. The regime could turn off the power in most of Berlin simply by pushing a switch, but they had to try.
And see who you can send to their homes. Tell them that their children have been arrested.
I can ask someone from downstairs, Leopold said after a moment. But that might be too revealing.
Be careful, Horst advised.
Whatever happened in the days and weeks that would come, a line had been crossed.
And watch your back.
There was a knock on the door. Horst swore inwardly as Sven hastily blanked the screen, then brought up a computer game he'd written himself. He'd told Horst that he had high hopes of selling millions of copies. Horst, privately, suspected it would be pointless to try until there were more than a handful of computers in civilian hands. Pushing the thought aside, he leaned over Sven's shoulder as the door opened. He'd rigged the doorknob to be harder to open quickly, and pretended to watch the game.
Horst, a gruff voice said, there's a telephone call for you.
Horst had to fight to keep his expression under control. He'd never thought highly of Krabbe. The would-be spy was suitable for nothing more than cannon fodder. But this was a new low. The telephone lines were down, and everyone knew it. Krabbe might just have blown his cover in one stupid moment. And even if there was a telephone line that was isolated from the rest of the landlines, which was technically possible, some of the students would still wonder. He could have said there was a message for me and it would be less revealing, he thought, straightening up. Something would have to be done about Krabbe. Horst's handler would probably be annoyed if he beat the idiot to within an inch of his life. But a careful report might see the stupid bastard reassigned to mine-clearing duty in Germany East. And now I have to come up with a cover story.
I'm coming, he said.
It was rare for parents to ring the university, and if they did, it was almost always an emergency. He glanced back at Sven, hoping the computer expert wasn't paying close attention.
I'll see you later.
Somehow, he resisted the temptation to punch Krabbe as soon as they left the computer lab and headed down the stairs. There were only a handful of students within earshot, but fighting in the corridors would be enough to get them both expelled, or, if their superiors intervened, raise yet more questions about why they hadn't been expelled. Horst silently wrote the report in his head, then decided it would be better not to write it. Krabbe was an idiot, but an idiot would be safer than someone competent. Unless, of course, he was a decoy.
You're wanted at the main office, Krabbe said, as soon as they were alone. Take one of the cars from the accommodation block and drive there.
And get arrested by the police, no doubt, Horst sneered.
What had happened to the sterilization camps? People like Krabbe shouldn't be allowed to breed.
None of our cars have any special plates to keep the police from flagging them down.
He shook his head. Being close to Krabbe was killing his brain cells.
I'll walk, he said, firmly, and you can go back to the apartment block and stay there.
Gritting his teeth, he hurried towards the gates. It could be a trap, he knew. His superiors might have reasoned out his role in the whole affair and called him in for an interrogation. But Krabbe didn't seem to be trying to follow him. If Horst had wanted to arrest someone on suspicion, he would have made sure the suspect didn't have a chance to saunter off into the back streets and escape. A public arrest would be easy enough, and, he was sure, it would arouse no comment. unless that was what he was meant to think.
It makes no sense, he reassured himself firmly. They wouldn't ask me to visit if they knew what I'd been doing. They'd grab me before I could escape. And so, whatever they want me for, I'm not in trouble myself. Hoping to hell he was right, he headed onwards through nearly deserted streets.
The sound of the riot, or protest march, or whatever the hell it was, quietened alarmingly, much to Hermann's relief, as the military police took over the sealed zone and marched the hundreds of prisoners away to an uncertain destination. Hermann was relieved just to see the back of some of the prisoners, particularly the ones who just would not shut up about how important they were and how the policemen would be shoveling shit in Germany East tomorrow if they didn't release their prisoners immediately. Let the military police handle the assholes, Hermann told himself, and take whatever punishment was due.
We're to head back to the muster point, Caius said.
The radio network had been having hiccups. Some idiot back at the station, according to rumor, had scrambled all the channels for some silly reason.
The military police are to take over the barricades.
Hermann shrugged. The barricades were no longer necessary now that most of the watching civilians had gone back home as soon as the military police arrived. God alone knew what they were saying, what rumors were spreading through the city, but for the moment, he found it hard to care. The buildings within the sealed zone had either been locked up tight by the strikers, who were now trapped, or emptied by the military police. Hermann rather doubted that anyone taken into custody by the military policemen would be enjoying the experience. He followed Caius back to the van and scrambled inside. The vehicle roared to life. He sat and forced himself to relax despite the tension. He'd expected worse, somehow, than merely putting up the barricades. But then, the military policeman had done the real job. And it isn't over yet, Hermann thought. The strikers will still have to be handled somehow.
We're being diverted, the driver called. There's a new crowd of people spilling out onto the street.
Hermann said nothing, but he worried as the van lurched. The strikers were bad enough. Who else was joining the protests and why? Caius and several of the other policemen hurled questions at the driver, but he didn't know anything more than what he'd already said. All they could do was wait, checking their weapons and equipment, until the van came to a halt one final time. The door opened, revealing a residential street, and hundreds of women of all ages marching down it, wearing their finest clothes. Caius gasped, "What the hell?" Hermann could only agree. He'd been prepared for rampaging students or workers, perhaps even Gastarbeiters, not women. Many of them were middle-aged, the same age as his wife, wearing outfits that cost more money than he cared to think about. They all looked to be respectable German womenfolk, wives and mothers. Indeed, some of the women were even carrying their children in their arms or pushing prams. He knew how to handle rioters, but women? The thought of charging them, of using tear gas to break up their ranks, was unthinkable. And then his blood ran cold as he saw his wife in the throng.
Adelinde? Your wife? Fritz asked. You'd better get her out of here before all hell breaks loose.
Hermann nodded, then hurried away from the clump of uncertain policemen. At least he had something to focus on, besides absolute confusion and unwillingness to treat the women as just another bunch of rioters. The captain would have to be insane to order the police to attack the crowd, not when it was so clearly composed of women and children. Hermann knew he would go deaf if the order was ever given, and, if his superiors were wise, they'd accept it rather than risk triggering a mutiny.
Adelinde, he said, as his wife looked up at him, what are you doing here?
Marching, Adelinde said.
She'd never argued with him in public before, even though she ruled the household with an iron hand.
They've arrested our daughter.
Hermann staggered backwards.
Gudrun had been arrested?
Of course she had, his thoughts yammered at him. It wasn't as if he had any other daughters, and yet
He hadn't seen her among the prisoners, but that proved nothing. Hell, Adelinda could be wrong. It wouldn't be the first time she'd jumped to the wrong conclusion and stuck to it in defiance of all logic and reason.
"You have to go home," he said.
He was the man of the house, damn it. His wife shouldn't be embarrassing him, let alone defying him in front of his comrades.
"Adelinda."
His wife tilted her head, looking alarmingly like his strong-willed mother.
"Our daughter is under arrest," she said, "merely for being a student. I'm not going home when she's in danger."
Hermann found himself unsure what to say, let alone do. Adelinda had always defended her children, even as she meted out strict discipline. He pitied the teacher who'd sent home a note accusing her children of atrocities. But coming out onto the streets, risking arrest or worse, he felt sick as he realized what Gudrun might have gone through already and what might be waiting in her future. His daughter was no criminal, no gastarbeiter bitch with no rights. She was a good little German girl, smart enough to be a university student, old enough to be a wife and a mother. His wife read the expression on his face.
"She's your daughter," she hissed. "Start doing your duty as a father and find her."
"We're not going home," an older woman said. She was well-dressed enough that Hermann had no trouble believing that her husband was both wealthy and very well-connected. God knew she certainly sounded snooty enough to believe herself above rebuke, let alone punishment.
"We want change."
"We want our sons home," another woman said.
A dozen other women took up the cry.
"We want an end to the war."
Defeated, Hermann could only turn and walk back to the other policemen, uncertain what he could say to them. Women were meant to obey their menfolk, first their fathers and then their husbands. But Adelinda had defied him publicly, and, if she was right about Gudrun being arrested, he couldn't blame her. Fritz eyed him as he rejoined the small clump of policemen.
"Well, I have to make a few calls," Hermann said. "Until then, we do nothing."
"And hope to hell our superiors don't do something stupid," he thought privately. Almost every policeman he knew was married. How many other wives and daughters of policemen had joined the marching women? He was damned if he was firing on a crowd that included his wife, the mother of his children. But what do we do if we are ordered to fire? Chapter 30. Berlin, Germany. 12 August, 1985.
"This is getting out of hand," Hans said.
He glanced at his watch meaningfully. It was late at night, and dusk was slowly settling over Berlin.
"The troubles are threatening to spread to a dozen other cities."
"Then we clamp down on them," Holliston insisted.
The Reichsführer SS hadn't given up. Not yet.
"We should crush the strikers in their lairs."
"If we kill the strikers, we lose part of our pool of trained labor," Hans said wearily.
The argument had been going in circles for hours, as more and more reports flooded in from all over the Reich. "If they have time to damage or destroy the machinery in the factories, we will have to replace it. And that will put yet another hole in our budget. And if we order the police or the troops to open fire on the women, we'll have a mutiny on our hands."
"He's right," Field Marshal Justus Stoffregen said.
The head of the OKW leaned forward, his face pale.
"There are already rumors spreading through the Berlin Guard,
Herr Reichsführer.
If they are sent in to clear the streets of women, I believe they will refuse to obey orders."
"So arrest them for mutiny," Holliston snapped.
"There hasn't been a mass mutiny since we were stabbed in the back in 1918, Stoffregen said. "A single coward could be arrested easily. His own barrack mates would hand out some rough justice if he wasn't arrested quickly enough. But a collective mutiny would be much harder to suppress. The soldiers might turn their guns on the arresting officers."
Holliston let out an angry hiss.
"This is what you get for not indoctrinating soldiers properly."
"Not all of us believe in the doctrines preached by the SS, Stoffregen said.
We want our soldiers to take advantage of fleeting opportunities, not wait for orders while the moment slips away.
Hans held up a hand. Normally, he would have enjoyed watching the military and the SS at loggerheads, but they didn't have time to continue the pointless argument. They'd played the only cards they could, firing Unionists and clearing the streets, and both had failed. The strikers were still holding out. Thousands of others had come onto the streets in support, and Berlin, as day turned to night, had ground to a halt. Even if the strike ended at midnight and the city went back to normal, it would take months, if not years, to repair the damage.
"This argument is immaterial," he said flatly. "We have to admit, right now, that we are on the verge of losing control."
He repeated the facts once again.
"There are rumblings of trouble right across the Reich," he said firmly. "I suspect we will see more strikes tomorrow. I believe that some corporations are already considering closing their plants for the duration of the crisis, which will only provoke their workers further. Our police have refused to disperse the women in the streets. Our soldiers are unlikely to fire on the women if ordered to do so. We have pushed matters as far as we can, without causing serious damage, and we can go no further. The population no longer trusts us. The workers no longer expect us to defend them against their corporate masters. The Untermenschen see their chance for freedom, and even the police and soldiers are restless. Our Reich rests on a knife edge."
"We can fight," Holliston said.
"We can try," Voss muttered.
"But there won't be much of a Reich left afterwards."
Hans nodded in agreement. "The Americans are already moving ahead of us," he reminded the council. "A long period of civil unrest in the Reich, even if we manage to keep a grip on power, will give them the chance to make their lead insurmountable, and then the legacy of the great Adolf Hitler will be lost forever." He willed them, desperately, to believe. The American ABM system was bad enough. If the Americans thought that they could stop 90% of the Reich's missiles, they might decide that they could survive a nuclear war, but their steady advance into space was worse. The Economic Intelligence Service was already predicting that the next generation of space-based weapons, concepts right out of American science fantasy movies, that if turned into reality, would render most of the Reich's armed forces obsolete. The Reich, already dangerously behind the United States, could not allow itself to lose any more ground. If they did, we might as well call Washington and ask President Anderson for terms, he thought sourly. We couldn't possibly win if they deploy space-based weapons against us.
"I agree," Stoffregen said. "It's time to put an end to the matter."
"And how," Holliston asked icily, "do you intend to do that?"
"We concede most of their demands," Hans said. "Let them have their unions for the moment. Let them have their freedom of speech and assembly. Let them even start offering independent candidates to the Reichstag."
"Out of the question," Holliston snapped.
"It makes no difference," Voss said, amused.
"The Reichstag is powerless."
"Unless these independent candidates start voting to block our proposed budgets," Holliston pointed out. "What do we do then?"
It was, Hans had to admit, a good question. Technically, the Reichstag was responsible for approving laws and budget proposals. None of the proposals put forward by the Reich Council had ever failed to pass, of course. The Reichstag knew it had no power to do anything other than rubber stamp the proposals. But if there were independents elected to the Reichstag, who knew what would happen then?
"We control the bureaucracy," he said finally.
He tried to make his tone as reassuring as possible.
"Let them make their speeches if they wish. It will make no difference. The important detail is that we will be buying time."
"We cannot end the war," Holliston snapped.
Hans nodded, although he knew the war couldn't be allowed to continue for long. But the military might not support him if he proposed otherwise. Not when Holliston, damn the man, had been making private deals with the senior officers. The war would have to continue for a few months at least. By then, he'd know just how badly the budget needed to be slashed to keep the Reich afloat.
We can shift responsibility onto the South Africans, Voss offered. If we provide training and equipment, even a handful of units of French volunteers, we can slowly draw down our own commitment. Let the bastards fight for their own country.
They are, Hans thought.
The Italians hadn't put up much of a fight when the Arabs revolted, and the French hadn't done much better. But the South Africans were tough. They were just outnumbered so badly that only superior training and their foes' disunity had kept them from losing the war within the first year, and maybe they will be glad of a few hundred thousand French volunteers.
Then we offer to concede most of the demands, Hans said, and release the prisoners as a gesture of good faith.
They are guilty of unauthorized political activity, Holliston insisted. They cannot simply be let free.
So is most of Berlin now, Hans countered. Do you want to put the entire city in extermination camps?
This isn't Warsaw or Moscow, Voss agreed.
Germanica, Holliston snapped.
Hans winced inwardly. Moscow, Stalin's capital, had been battered to rubble by savage street fighting as the Germans forced their way into the city. Half of the population had died at their posts. The remainder had been rounded up, marched into a concentration camp, and starved to death. The city had been rebuilt shortly after the end of the war. It had been the hub of the USSR's road and rail network, and renamed Germanica. These days, it was an SS stronghold, the core of Germany East.
Let them go, he said gently. It will help to buy us time.
Very well, Holliston snapped. Let it be done.
You're late, Standartenfuhrer Erdmann Schwarzkopf observed. I had problems convincing the police of my identity, Horst said shortly. He was sick of being told he was late. They did not believe me at first. He scowled at the humiliation of admitting that he'd practically been arrested by his own side. If he'd had an SS card, getting past the policeman would have been simplicity itself. But the card would have been far too revealing if Gudrun or another student had seen it. As it happened, he'd had to let them take him to a processing station and speak to an SS officer there, and by the time he'd been processed himself, several hours had passed. Schwarzkopf shrugged. These are not easy times. No, Horst agreed. He bit down the urge to lodge a complaint against Krupp. I never expected to see the streets of Berlin filled with whining women.
Me neither, Schwarzkopf said.
He sounded, for once, just a little unsure.
A number of students were arrested, mostly in front of the factories. I need you to review their files and mark any that require special attention.
Horst frowned inwardly as he took the set of folders. Every student had a dossier, kept within the RSHA. He had no doubt that the SS's bureaucrats were hastily updating them even now, at least for the students who'd been arrested. They might be released, computer experts were invaluable, but being arrested in such a compromising position would haunt them for the rest of their lives. And yet, they were the lucky ones. Someone without their training would be halfway to Germany East by now. The first batch of students were largely unfamiliar to him, although he vaguely recognized one of the young men as a braying fool who'd bragged of his family connections to anyone who'd listen. One of the young girls, his eyes lingered on the photos of her processing for longer than he knew they should, had a brother who'd gone to war and never returned. He hoped, as he returned the first stack of files, that her loss wouldn't be held against her. She had an excellent motive for joining the Valkyries.
That young man is a loudmouth, he said, tapping his folder. But I don't think he's a real troublemaker. He has too much to lose.
Schwarzkopf eyed him sharply.
Two of the other spies have classed him as a potential dissident.
Horst forced himself to keep his voice level.
Mein Herr, he talks too much, he said.
He was tempted to drop the idiot in hot water, but that would be cruel. A dissident would be quieter, I believe.
His talk is already seditious, Schwarzkopf pointed out.
He picked up the next set of folders and held them out.
And these?
The first two folders showed boys he didn't recognize, but the third folder belonged to Gudrun. He glanced at her photographs first, hoping that his superior would think he was admiring her body if he showed any reaction, then checked the rest of the file. Thankfully, Gudrun seemed to have been classed as someone who'd been in the wrong place at the wrong time, rather than a potential dissident. The bureaucrats hadn't known she'd been engaged to Conrad before he'd been sent to South Africa. Having a policeman for a father probably told in her favor, although she also had a tie to the SS. Horst made a mental note to consider that later, wondering what the tie actually was. Gudrun's elder brother was in the Berlin Guard, not the Waffen SS, and her other brothers were still in the Hitler Youth. It was unlikely as hell they were already marked down as potential SS recruits. Only bad fiction for impressionable young men involved children serving as full-fledged secret agents charged with hunting down spies. "I know her from my classes," he said. He made a show of looking back at the pictures. "I was planning to court her."
"I can understand why," Schwarzkopf said. "Pretty, definitely. Her bloodline shows no trace of non-Aryan blood."
Horst flushed on Gudrun's behalf, silently praying she never found out that he'd looked at her naked photographs, then frowned as the implication struck him. If she'd wanted to marry an SS officer, she needed a certificate of racial purity, a confirmation that her parents and grandparents had been of pure German blood. He wondered suddenly why someone had looked up Gudrun's bloodline. It wasn't normally done outside the SS. But the file provided no answer. There had to be a connection between Gudrun and the SS he wasn't seeing.
"I still may do so," he said.
He put the file back and took the next one.
"Unless it would impact on my career." "It probably wouldn't," Schwarzkopf assured him. "She doesn't seem to be one of the ringleaders."
"And let us hope you're telling the truth," Horst thought, as he checked the next file. "If a competent spy saw us together, you might wonder."
"Another loudmouth," he said, dismissing the subject. The male student was 2 years older than him and completely unconnected to Gudrun. This one, however, was involved with inciting students to go to the factories.
Schwarzkopf frowned.
"Are you sure?"
"He wasn't the only one," Horst said. He would have preferred not to mention it, but the idiot just had to shoot his mouth off in public, where one of the other spies would definitely have heard. Better he ended up in an interrogation chamber than Horst himself.
"There were a couple of others I don't know so well." "Several students are also dead," Schwarzkopf said. "They may have hoped to be killed."
"Only the Arabs charge into battle praying for death," Horst said. The SS praised death before the dishonor of running away. But even the most fanatical unit understood the value of a tactical retreat.
"I don't think the students would have enough bravery to make a fight of it."
"This one did," Schwarzkopf said. He held up another file. Inside, there was a picture of a brutally wounded young man.
"Do you recognize him?"
"Hartwig," Horst said. He hadn't liked the young man. He'd lured Gudrun into danger. But he hadn't deserved to die so savagely.
"Hartwig Grinland. Another loudmouth."
"Noted," Schwarzkopf said. They ran through the rest of the files quickly.
"Do you know any of the students personally?"
"A few," Horst said. Thankfully, he knew more than just Gudrun and the Valkyries.
"I have classes with them." "We have orders to release them tomorrow morning, save for a handful who merit further investigation," Schwarzkopf said. "Do you want to drive any of them home?"
Horst kept his expression blank with an effort. He needed to talk to Gudrun, and he needed to do it before she vanished into her home. Her father was a policeman, after all. He'd be embarrassed when he discovered that his daughter had been arrested, even if it didn't blight his career for the rest of his life. Horst knew what his father would have done if he'd gotten into real trouble, and he doubted Gudrun's father would take it any better. But then, Gudrun was a girl. She might just be grounded for the rest of her life instead. But if he showed any interest in any of the girls, his superior might wonder why. Unless, of course, he gave them a good reason.
"I can drive Gudrun home," he said, pasting a smile on his face. "She might appreciate it."
"She might," Schwarzkopf said. We're asking students to drive the arrestees home, rather than allow their parents to collect them in a body. Listen carefully to what she says as you drive her home. If she happens to say anything actionable, report it to us.
I will, Horst said. He'd check the car overnight, just to make sure no